Okay. If you would, please, turn with me to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3. Now, I preached a sermon during Sunday school, the Thomas Watson sermon, 370 years ago. Did that for Sunday school. This is going to seem more like a Sunday school maybe than a sermon. I can assure you that though there be a drought of the word for a few pages of the sermon, you will be bombarded in the end. So hopefully it will indeed be a sermon. But as I said, this may feel more like a Sunday school going through terminology and such. And Sunday school was indeed just a plain sermon. Well, I wouldn't say plain to Brother Watson, but I would say that a profound sermon. Okay. Hebrews chapter 3. Now, we've read one of the warning passages already. Whenever I say warning passages, every time I say warning passages, just picture me doing this, okay? Because that's kind of what they're called. You'll read those in books, different textbooks. The first warning passage that we read was in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 1. It reads, "Therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away." Now, we kind of blew over that one a little bit, right? But there's a reason why. Drift away from the faith. You mean we can lose our faith? And we have a warning here in verse 6 of chapter 3, and indeed, it actually remains all through the end of the chapter. We're going to come up on one of the biggest of all in chapter 6, and then another real big one in Hebrews chapter 10. Actually, if you were to do a study of Hebrews, which I know we're kind of doing that, but if you were to do a study of Hebrews, you would find that the exhortations are all put in warning form. And that the doctrine of Christ is actually put in place in order to set up the warning. Doctrine of Christ put in place to set up the warning. That indeed the entire book of Hebrews is really, you know, warning passages. Now, it's also called apostasy passages. Now, Calvinists are quick when it comes to showing all the passages that speak of security, that speak of assurance, election, and such. But many Calvinists, and I'm not speaking of scholars here, okay? I'm speaking of Calvinists sitting in the pew. Many of them are lacking in the study of the apostasy passages like the ones before us, okay? Now, what they'll do is if you mention apostasy, they'll say, what about all those verses over there that say this, this, and this about assurance? Which is fine. We should know those. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to spend the time today looking at those verses. But we still need to exegete the passages that speak on apostasy without it making it look like we're twisting and doing backflips, okay? And that's where I think a lot of people lack. Both types of passages should be studied. The assurance type, and the ones that seem to be contradicting the assurance types passages, because we know that we're not going to find contradictions, so we need to know how to deal with them. That's going to be our goal starting today. It's not going to be exhaustive, and the reason why it's not going to be exhaustive, as I said, chapter 6 and chapter 10, we will again spend a few weeks looking at it there. So the goal then is going to be to look at some aspects of apostasy or assurance for the next week or two. Then we'll leave off, and whenever we get to chapter 6, we will look at different aspects that really pertain to what he's dealing with there, and then the same in chapter 10, and maybe even in chapter 12, we'll do that also. Now today what I want to do is just deal with some terminology. I know what you're going to think, well, wait a minute, everybody knows what the meaning of these words are. Just maybe everyone doesn't. Or maybe what we want to do is just get a good, nice little Reader's Digest type version of some terminology because we want to keep it in play. Again, we're going to apply it next week, okay? So we're really kind of setting it up to exegete the passage for next week. Some may not be familiar with it, so let's just go ahead and go through it. Now then, hopefully, by the time we finish the book of Hebrews, we're going to have a very good look at the apostasy passages. Because I can tell you this, if you were a person that said you could lose your salvation, the book of Hebrews is ripe with the passages. So we want to make sure that we do our due diligence here. Let's go ahead and let's read our text now, just to get a context. Verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 3, "Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession." So right there he calls them Christians and holy brothers. But, verse 2, "who is faithful to him who was appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in all God's house, for Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of the house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all of God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son," and here we go, "and we are his house if we hold fast our confidence and our boasting and our hope. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion on the day of testing in the wilderness, where your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation. They always go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways. I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." And then, "take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have come to share in Christ," here we go, "if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end. As it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not those who left Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief." Amen. Now you can see the areas of concern in that chapter. This passage is light compared to chapter 6 and chapter 10. That's why we're just going to kind of break ground a little bit. Many, as I said, call these apostasy verses. Now, what does the word apostasy mean? Like I said, I know some of the terminology you know, but let's Reader's Digest versions is what we're going to go with, okay? Apostasy, the abandonment or renunciation of a religious or political belief. In the Greek, apostasis is defection. So you cannot be an apostate if you are just an unbeliever that never confessed Christ. You understand? It's impossible to be an apostate if you have not professed something, because you have to defect from it or renounce it or abandon it. Okay? That's what an apostate does. An apostate has said, "This is me," and then later on he says, "It ain't me," or he just abandons it, or he just defects from it by action or word, okay? Renounce is word, okay? Abandon could be action. Okay. Julian the Emperor, or Julian the Apostate, Thomas Watson mentioned him in his sermon over the Sunday school, right? But Julian the Apostate, okay, remember whenever we did early church history? Julian the Apostate was a relative of Constantine. Constantine dies. Remember, his boys take over. And then Julian is a relative of them. He's waiting. And remember, now that the whole society is Christian, Julian's, "Oh yeah, I'm Christian." He does all that, right? And then as soon as the boys go down, he ends up being the emperor of the Roman Empire. He unzips the sheep's clothing and he says, "Ta-da, I never was a Christian. But now that I have the power, it doesn't matter." And then remember, he goes against and he wants to bring back in pagan practices. That would be an apostate. That's why they call it Julian the Apostate. He professed something, right? And then he defected or renounced it or abandoned it. That's apostasy. Now, people say that these are apostasy verses. And the question is, can a believer apostatize? Now, a Calvinist says no. Now, remember, we said believer, right? This is the key. True believer, let's put it that way. Whenever I say believer, I don't mean believe, I mean true believer. A Calvinist says no. An Arminian says yes. And here's a term you probably don't know. A grace evangelical says it doesn't matter. Now, what is a grace evangelical? We'll get to that in a minute. A Calvinist says a believer cannot apostatize, but a professed believer, okay, that's not a believer, that's just one that says, okay, a professed believer, that is one that says that they are a believer but really aren't, they of course can, because that would be the meaning of apostasy for them. The Arminian, of course, says, sure, a believer can. That's why, they would say, that's why these passages are written, to encourage them to keep on working, to stay in the grace of God, so that they don't die unbelievers. That's what they would do with Hebrews 3. Now, how many of you have heard the term, once saved, always saved? Right? O-S-A-S. I would ask you, do you believe it? Once saved, always saved. Many people will say, oh, you know what? I am Calvinistic whenever it comes to salvation. I believe in one of the points of Calvinism, and that is once saved, always saved. Okay. Well, that's not one of the points of Calvinism. For those that think that it is, that is misnomer, it's not. What is meant by such a statement is that once you have been saved, okay, truly saved, okay, there is nothing that can undo your salvation. Now, the folks that hold to this statement are many times the just say a prayer and you're in folks. Okay, you just say a prayer, you're in, and once saved, you're always saved. Nothing can undo that prayer that you just said right there. Okay? And they use Romans 10:9 for that. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Confess with your mouth, that's the say a prayer part. That's where they get to say a prayer part. And believe that God raised Jesus from the dead, and you, my friend, are in, and once in, you're always in. Nothing you could do that would wreck your salvation. Now, the Calvinist position is this. Once saved, you are always saved. You go, wait a minute, though. You said that that's not perfect. Once saved, always saved. But that is not one of the 5 points of Calvinism. The fifth point of Calvinism is the perseverance of the saints. Okay, people say, once saved, always saved. No, the result of the perseverance of the saints would be once saved, but that's not what the point is. And this is what's key. Okay, this is what's key here. Perseverance. Let's just take perseverance and what that word means. Because, you know, you have the two-lip. P is perseverance. Okay, perseverance doesn't mean once saved, always saved. Perseverance is to remain steadfast in a course of action despite difficulty or delay in achieving success. It's not always difficulty. It could be just a delay in it. But you persevere into that thing. Okay? So if I was going out, I want to be a tennis player, and I'm out there hitting balls, it may not be because of a trial, right, that I can't play tennis, but it's just a delay in me getting a little bit better. But if I persevere, okay, that's perseverance. Okay. So, it says perseverance is to remain steadfast. How many times did you read the word steadfast whenever we read that chapter? See kind of what he's talking about? They use a different word, but in a sense it's to persevere. He's saying, make sure that if you are indeed persevering, if you're steadfast. Okay. The doctrine of perseverance of the saints is this. Okay, this is what the fifth point is. Again, these are just Reader's Digest type versions. But the fifth point is, if you are saved, you will persevere in the faith. Okay, that is, you will continue in the life of faith, Okay? If you are indeed in the faith, you will persevere in that faith. Okay? You understand what it's saying? That's not the same thing. Now, the result of you persevering, and because you are saved, you will continue to do the things that you are called to do in your faith. Okay? You will continue to walk according to your calling, Ephesians 4:1. Right? That's persevering in the faith. Okay? So there is what? A steadfastness in the faith, regardless of difficulty or delay in something coming to fruition. So you will keep going in the faith. Okay. The result, of course, will be, if you are in the faith, you would be saved. Right? Once saved, always saved. That's the result of that. But you have to see the difference. The once saved, always saved crowd does not even broach the subject, if you notice, of persevering in the life of faith. You understand? All of your friends that go to Evangelical ABC Church, they'll talk about once saved, always saved. They are never, ever talking about you being a believer persevering in the life of faith. You understand the difference there, right? One is the ultimate result. The other is the actual doctrine, perseverance of faith in the believer. Okay? So once saved, always saved never, ever broaches the subject of persevering, walking in the life of faith. It's just telling you what the end result is going to be. Now, the life of faith will continue. Now, we know that we're going to fall into sin for a time. If we read our confession and say, yes, you will fall into sin for a time, right? But the fruits of the Spirit, overall, all of those things, you will walk according to your heavenly calling. That's a very big difference and a very big doctrine compared to once saved, always saved. Let's look at another term. Now, this is a term you guys may not be familiar with. Some of you, I'm sure, are. The term is called preservation, not perseverance. Preservation. That is to keep or preserve the status or state of something. Now, that's the God side, we'll say. Jesus says, none can snatch them out of my hand. Well, what he means is, he keeps or preserves those, right, that are his. And here's the thing. Now that we know those two terms, what is it that people lean on? They lean on the preservation, right? People lean on the doctrine of preservation, not on the doctrine of perseverance, right? They keep looking at God's side of it. They just push, they remove themselves from it. Now, the Calvinist believes in preservation and in perseverance. He believes that God preserves us in our salvation, and one of the means is to call us to persevere. Now, people say, wait a second. Then that must be works. If he's preserving us because, I never said because we're persevering. I said one of the ways that he preserves us is through a means called perseverance. Well, no, then that's the man that's doing it all. Okay, let's put it like this. How many people would agree that everything that you've gotten is from God? Everybody, hopefully, I hope so. Yeah, okay, all right. Okay, that means our car, right, our house, okay, the $5 in our pocket. Except I'm a light, but still, the $5 in our pocket, okay. So he's the provider of those things, right? Okay, now then. So if you said, God is the provider of everything I have. Okay. Did the $5 come floating down from heaven and go into your pocket? Right? No. How did the $5 that God provided come about? He does use means, right? And one of the means that he uses is he provides you with health and with a job, right? And with the health and a job, you go out and do that. That's not a works thing. That's his different ways that he provides. It's means that he gives us, right? Like prayer is a means, right, with communion to God, okay? But that's not a works to go there. It's just a means. So whenever we talk about preservation, God preserving you, he uses means. One of the means is to call you to perseverance also. Because perseverance is always going to be keeping in communion with God. Now, the Arminian believes in preservation, that's God keeping you, and perseverance. The Arminian, and you go, wait a minute, I thought the Calvinists believed in preservation and perseverance. Well, the Arminian believes in preservation and perseverance also, but it is man that preserves his status with God through his own perseverance. You see the difference there? Man preserves his status through his own perseverance. What the Calvinists say, no, no, God preserves. One of the means that he does is he calls us, right, and gives in us the Spirit to keep us in perseverance. Okay. So the Arminian would say, hey, look, if a guy wants to get to heaven, he will need to persevere. If he does not persevere, he has not preserved himself. See? Okay, you kind of see the difference there. Though. All right. Now, don't think, because I know there's a lot of people that think that today's churches are Arminian in thinking. That's not true. Okay? That's not true at all. They're not, in this particular doctrine, they are not Arminian in thinking at all. I mean, I don't want to say I wish they were, but I almost wish that they were in certain ways. They go by something that's called a grace evangelical doctrine. There's actually a grace evangelical society. Okay? And there's grace evangelical churches. Now, there are grace evangelical pastors that don't go to a grace evangelical church. They may go to the church right down the street, for all I know, or the one right up here. I have no idea. But they're everywhere. And if your church is looking for a grace evangelical pastor, you can contact the society in other places, and they will hook you up with one. But what is it? Because if today's churches don't follow the perseverance of the saints doctrine. They don't follow the Arminian, you must keep doing and following on. Okay, they're not going to follow that. So what is this grace evangelical doctrine? Why has it taken over almost every single church out there? It has. Some don't even realize what they are, but you can actually go Grace Evangelical Society. You could read that statement and see what it is. The statement's true, but you've got to know what they're actually saying. This society was started by Zane Hodges. Now, I don't know if you guys know who Zane Hodges is. I know a few of you folks know who he is. He's a dispensational who was a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary for years. And he leaves and he starts the Grace Evangelical Society. He separates preservation from perseverance. You see, a Calvinist, they're both went together, right? With an Arminian, they both go together. He takes and he separates preservation from perseverance. He says, your salvation is dependent on God preserving you, not on your perseverance and faith. Anything else is works. You do not need to persevere. God preserves. And if you have any part in it, it works. Well, now, we would agree with that to a certain extent, right? Well, it's not a need, but we'll get to that later on. What is his doctrine? His doctrine is once saved, always saved, isn't it? See, because once saved, always saved is not a Calvinistic doctrine. It's not an Arminian doctrine. And if you were to go back 30 or 40 years ago, you wouldn't hear the doctrine of once saved, always saved like you hear today. The reason that you hear it is because that's where it comes from, right there. Perseverance, right, is completely separated from God's preservation. Just throw it aside. He, of course, misunderstands the Calvinistic point. The Calvinist is not saying you must persevere in order to be preserved. That's an Arminian doctrine. Okay? He's misunderstanding. Now, this is a professor. Now, if you know anything about him, he has many, many books. He's been a professor for many, many years. But he misrepresents the Calvinistic side. A Calvinist does not say you must persevere in order to be preserved. The doctrine states that once you are truly saved by the grace of God, you are truly changed. That's the Calvinistic doctrine. You're truly changed. You're renewed. You become a new creation. And you will persevere in the faith because of the grace of God upon you. So we say we will persevere because we have been saved. Okay, see, so he's kind of misrepresenting that part of it. They never say you must persevere in order to be saved. excuse me, the Calvinist believes that the work of grace in a believer, and here's a big distinction between the carnal Christian crowd, the Arminian crowd, and the Calvinistic crowd. A Calvinist believes that the grace in a believer is so strong, that it's so great, that it is so life-changing, that it is so efficacious, that you will be changed and you will respond in love, in evangelical obedience to God's word. That's where the perseverance comes in. That's why it says you will persevere, because it's the strength of the grace in the renewal of your life. For a professor to say obedience or perseverance is a work, that's actually, I can't say that it is deceitful. I'll say it's a very foolish thing to say. Because if I'm a professor, and I've been a professor at a leading seminary, I know what the Reformation cry was. The Reformation cry was justification by faith alone and Christ alone. And it was against the works of Catholicism. So that's not a very fair thing to say of characterizing the doctrine of perseverance. But think about his society, the Grace Evangelical Society. Think about what it's saying. Okay, now, so let's think about this. Preservation is by God. Well, we agree with that. And what you do does not matter one bit. Well, I encourage you to go to their website, Grace Evangelical Society, and it's .org, and you can look at their statement. If you have faith alone in Christ alone, you're in. And you go, wait a minute, we believe that. Yes. But see, they're attaching themselves to the once saved, always saved. They're only looking at preservation by God. They're not looking at what someone does that's in the faith. See, this is the problem. It almost comes down, if you look at perseverance, preservation, really being born again, faith, you really almost have to look at the doctrine of faith, right? Because that will tell us what party is right. Right? Well, that's what's going to tell us what party is right here. Because if you're thinking of this guy's doctrine, I know what you're thinking of. You're thinking, that sounds like he's got a doctrine of the carnal Christian. You can be saved, do this, do that. You separate those two. Perseverance has nothing, and it's right here, right? Do whatever you do. Remain on the throne. Get off the throne. Kick them off the throne twice a day, whatever it is, and you're fine. But you're right. That is also part of that doctrine, isn't it? So let's review here. The positions. Apostasy. That is the abandoning or renunciation of belief. A stated belief. Can a real believer do this? Calvinist position on salvation is one who believes will persevere in the faith. He will never renounce it, abandon it, and will continue to walk in it, though for a time he may walk away from it. The Arminian position says you better get busy and stay busy if you want to stay in God's grace. The Grace Evangelical position is, as long as you have faith, your work, your walk does not matter. So the first guy says, if you're saved, you will walk according to your calling. That's what the Calvinist says. I mean, we're Reader's Digest, we're keeping it simple. Calvinist says, if you're saved, you will walk according to your calling. Second guy, the Arminian, says, if you want to remain saved, you will walk according to your calling. And the third group, sadly, the default in most churches today, the third group, as long as you have faith, it matters not how you walk, you are secure. Now, why is that a dangerous? It's true, if you have faith, you are secure. But why is that a dangerous doctrine to say it in that manner? It's because we need to know, now we need to have a definition of faith. Right? Because, you know, if I'm part of Professor Hodges' church, I have faith. You're secure. Well, wait a second. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about any of this. You're preserved. I'm separating the two for you. You're preserved. Don't worry about it. What faith? What faith? What kind of faith is it? What does it look like? Right? Is it just going to be dangling? That's going to be it? Let's turn to Matthew 7, please. Because here's the question. We now need to know what faith looks like or whatever it is, because you have all these, you have Arminian saying faith is this, and you can go in and out of it. You have a Calvinist that says, no, that kind of faith will do this. And this guy says, no, no, no. This kind of faith is just faith. It has nothing to do with doing anything else. This kind of faith can be bland, a blank screen, or whatever, all the way until the time you die. And here is the death that is the grace evangelical position. Because we need to look at what faith is. What is true saving faith? Does it look like anything? Okay? Is there a faith that you can deceive yourself? Is there a faith that's not saving faith? All of those things. Does it do anything? Now, we would agree that there is a transitory, or let me put it this way, temporary faith, right? We would agree with that, right? Okay? If we read the parables of the soils, and I say the parables of the soils, not the parable of the sower, but the soils, it's really a teaching about soil. It's really a teaching about what the gospel does whenever it hits a heart of stone or a heart that's been prepared beforehand for it. We would see that certain people, even though the gospel is thrown out there, react. Right? And the one that is in that shallow ground, right? That's what's underneath there, hardness, right? It's not prepared soil. That rock was never meant. Even by the farmer, it was never meant to produce that crop. But it grows, but what is it that shows that it was never prepared down below? The sun, trials, tribulations come. It proves them. But we would look at that and say, faith. Zane Hodges would say, ah, right there, that guy's got faith, you're secure. And then whenever the trials come and then the thing withers, he would still say it matters not if there's a perseverance because he will be preserved. You see, that's the death in that message. There's never any good soil. It was never born again. It was never a heart that was prepared to accept it. So it never would grow. But it would show up for a little bit. That's that transitory or temporary faith. So whenever Hodges says, you got faith, you're in. What does he do whenever the guy has trials and tribulations? You find out the seed never went into a new heart. It never went into a born-again soul. Yet that man will be able to sit in that pew with the security of thinking that he's going, because here's the problem. It's going to look like something. The parable of the soils tell us it will look like something. It will do something. There's going to be something attached to it. If those roots are in good ground, then something's going to be attached to it. Listen to John 2:23. I know you guys are in Matthew. We're going to get there in just a second. Just listen to John 2:23. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name. Listen to this. Many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. I say, well, Professor Hodges, there's faith. It says right there. Many believed in his name whenever they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus did not entrust himself. So there's faith, right? That's faith. Believe. Okay? Well, ask Hodges. There's faith. And in his church, that person that has faith is preserved to the end. Doesn't matter what anything looks like. They have nothing to worry about. But do you understand what it says there? Jesus could look inside the ground to see if there was a rock right underneath that soil. What did it say? It said he didn't entrust himself. He needed no one to bear witness about him, for he himself knew what was in man, i.e. a hard heart with those people. Right? They believed, like that soil, in the, you know, the rock, the seed, but he knew. He couldn't. Now, here's the thing. Jesus can tell. It says he doesn't need anyone to tell. Okay? We don't have Jesus around to say, that faith is no good. Sorry. No, nope, that faith isn't saving faith. We don't have that. But do we have any help that might help us that we're not the John 2:23, 2:25 person? Right? That we're not the plant that's in the soil or in the rocks. Now some, many, should I say, will not know until the day they die. I got a feeling there's going to be a whole lot of them in Professor Hodges' churches that aren't going to know until the day they die. Many that believe in the doctrine of the carnal Christian are going to experience this. Look at your Matthew 7 passage. I know you know the passage, but here's the thing. Here's what we're looking for. Are there any traits that might indicate what saving faith looks like? Okay? Not the traits that made it saving, but what saving faith looks like. Verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Everyone then who hears the words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rocks. Now, here they're dying. This is it. The depart is the final. Okay? No second. This is it. They're dying. There are many people, many, that's the heartbreaking part. Many are going to die this way. There's a solution for that, though, in a little bit. But here they die. They prophesy, they preach, but they never actually knew God. Notice, if you want some help, Jesus is going to help us. Look at some traits, the actions of someone that has saving faith. Okay? Notice what he says here, some of the traits. Verse 21, the one who does the will of my Father. That must mean that's one that he's going to say, I knew, and don't depart from me. So we see, now there's a trait. Now, does that work? Does that mean you have to do the will of the Father in order to be? Or is that just a trait of one that, hey, you know what? The one that does the will of my Father, he's him. Not because he does the will, maybe, but just it's just a trait. It's what one, a guy looks like. Okay. He's the one that goes into heaven is the one that does the will of the Father. Verse 23, the ones that don't have that trait, but actually have exactly opposite, they are the workers of lawlessness. Remember, that's the ones that he says depart from. Which, a worker of lawlessness is what? Exactly opposite of doing the will of my Father, right? That's what makes it lawlessness. So he's saying, okay, if they're workers of lawlessness, they're not in, and I don't know them. But, on the flip side, the ones that do the will. Now, is that working to get there? I think we'll find out later on it's not going to be. Verse 24, there are other ones that will be in heaven. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them. Now again, let's stay away from the works thing. Right now, we don't know if it's works or not. Let's just be fair. What we know is that what he's saying is the guy that goes to heaven is going to be a guy of action. We can see that much right now. The guy that will not get to heaven is going to be a worker of lawlessness. And the guy that does not do those things, but does exactly opposite. We'll leave off the works part right now. He's not saying here. He's telling us the one that he knows goes about his business. What he's not saying, he knows them because they do God's will, but the ones he knows, that is the saved ones, do this, and the unsaved act in this manner. So far, that's all we can get out of it. The one he knows does the work of the Father. The ones that he does to are workers of lawlessness. So we can start seeing some things. So far, after this point, I fear for those that have a grace evangelical pastor in their pulpit. Jesus speaking in John 8, you don't need to turn there. John 8, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him. Listen to what he says. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. Now, could we flip that around? If you don't abide in my word, you're truly not my disciples, which would go well with Matthew 7, I think, right? Okay, there's another trait that is found in true disciples. If you are truly a disciple, not to be a disciple, right? But if you are truly a disciple, you abide in his word. God help those that play with this fire, because this is what this is. Let's turn to 2 John, please. 2 John chapter 2. 2 John chapter 2. While you're turning there, let me just read 1 John chapter 2 to you. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that it might become plain that they were not of us. There's that renunciation, right? That abandonment. Okay? But he says they never were. That's why we say, that's why a Calvinist so far, right, would say that if they fall away and leave, that is abandon or apostatize, they never were. By the way, it's apostatize, not apostatize. One probably has something to do with going big at McDonald's. It's apostatize. So if we were to take the 1 John 2 passage I just read, you should be in 2 John 2 now, but if we were going to, or 2 John now, if we were to look at what we've seen so far, those that would abandon us were never of us, and we see that there's lawlessness, people will abide if you're truly a disciple. Right now, if we were honest, right now, the Calvinist position seems stronger than the other two, but we're still going to have to deal with our Hebrews text, so next week, right? Okay. But right now, I mean, if we were to be fair, we'd say, okay, if you're truly my disciples, you're going to abide in my words, you're going to do, okay, we see that. And we see also that it must be a professed believer because John says they were never really of us even though they were hanging out with us and they deserted us. Okay, 2 John, verse 9. Everyone, this is key, everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. Okay? Now, you see, an Arminian can still, they're still shaking their head yes to us right now, right? Okay. But we see what we're doing is we're jettisoning a doctrine of death that's out there now in most churches, right? Okay. It seems pretty plain. A death awaits many that fall for the grace evangelical position that Hodge and others push. Now, remember here, it does not say that you must abide to have God, right? Let's make sure that we're clear here. It doesn't say that you must abide to have God, but that you do not have Him if you're not abiding. Okay? Let's make sure that we're clear there. Here's the thing. It's not conditional. The statement is not conditional, right? It's declarative. It's declaring your position. If this is this, then that is that. It's not a condition that you have to do that. Okay. It goes on. Whoever abides in his teaching, okay, has, not will have because they abide, but whoever abides in his teaching has. Okay, that's someone that they have. They're abiding in this teaching, both the Father and Son. And then here's the thing. You say, well, can it get any better? There's a special message here for Professor Hodges and all pastors that preach death and preach the carnal Christian doctrine. Verse 10. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, verse 9, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked ways. So if someone is not bringing the teaching of verse 9, you're part of that, you're taking part in his wicked ways. Another way of looking at it is this. Okay, we've looked at a few things about disciple and faith, okay, because we want to get a picture of faith. We see there's transitory faith, right? Temporary faith. We see there's faith that's not saving faith in John 2, where he says he's not entrusting himself, right? And we see the ones that are neither one of them had a good heart. So really, we look at faith, but what do we really need to do? We need to look at the subject of being born again. Can the doctrine of being born again or regenerated give us a clue under which of the three positions is there? I think it can. Turn to 1 John, please. Just go back. 1 John 2, please. Now then, you remember what the Calvinist position was about grace? It is so efficacious, so great, that it renewed us and changed us that we can do nothing but be a different person and go towards God. That's the grace that's at work with us. Now, you're in 1 John 2, but let me read Titus 3:5 to you. And listen to Titus 3:5. He saved us not because of works done by our righteousness, okay, in us by in righteousness, but according to his own mercy. How does he save us? By the washing of regeneration, that's the born again, and the renewal of the Holy Spirit. See, that's what the Calvinists say. This is how. Because we have changed. We weren't saved and not changed. We were saved. We were born again. We were renewed. Now then, look at your 1 John chapter 2 and verse 29. If you know that he is righteous, you may be sure that everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. Everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. Not you are born of him because you did righteousness, right? It's exactly opposite of that, isn't it? That's that change, that grace that goes on you. But you may be sure everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. That is, after they've been born again, they will practice righteousness. Hodges says no. He says they could. He's saying it doesn't matter. Carnal Christian believers say no, or at least it doesn't matter. Now, I know what some of you guys, look at that text there I just read for you. I know what some of you guys, because some of you guys are kind of slick. You're going to say, wait a second. You've told me to be very careful whenever I read statements like that. It does not say that all of those that are born again will, just all who are born again. You see what it says here? You know that he is righteous. You may be sure that everyone who practices righteousness is born again. But it doesn't say that everyone that's born again practices righteousness, does it? It doesn't say that. So we want to make sure. We don't want to use a verse like this against somebody because they're going to point that out. They're going to say, whoa. Does not say everyone born again practices righteousness. It just says all who practice righteousness have been born again. You're right. Now take your finger, go up to chapter 3, and look at verse 9. No one born of God, now it's no one, now we're more complete, makes a practice of sinning. If you've been born of God, you will not continue in sin. You may sin, but it's speaking of a continual sin. See, we're just trying to look and understand faith a little bit. What is the picture the Bible gives us of true faith? What is the picture that the Bible gives us of being born again? Because it's going to help us whenever we go to Hebrews, right? It should help us. Go up to chapter 5. Chapter 5 in 1 John. This is a text that they use. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. Some say there. If you believe, you're born again. That's what we've been saying all along. I would say yes. We agree with that. But what we want to do is find out what faith and belief look like. And you've got to remember, John chapter 5, verse 1 was written by the same guy that wrote this book, right? By the same author, speaking on the same subject, right? In all those chapters we just looked at, right? We've got to take all those born again in the same book by the same author at the same time, right? And he says, that type of belief that I'm speaking of in John chapter 5, verse 1, is the type that does righteousness and does not continue sinning. See? That's why we have to be very careful that we don't take out a verse and say, here's my doctrine right here. Because that's what they're doing with John 5, 1. They say, no. Let's stay within the book and let's look and see what it is that being born again is all about. You can't just grab a text and run. And then if you were to go down another verse to verse 4, it says, for everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. Now, what do we do if we want to find out what overcome means? Well, we could go to the author, same author. We go to Revelation. He explains what overcome means, right, whenever he's writing the letters to the churches. What is that all about? It's about doing. It's about remaining faithful. It's about pushing off evil, not letting error into the church. It's doing. It's action. Overcoming is action. Verse 18. We know that everyone who has been born, now it's everyone. Everyone who has been born of God does not keep on sinning. So, we have an idea. We're starting to see what saving faith looks like, right? Saving faith is not going to wilt under trial, right, for the parable of the soils. Okay, saving faith is just not any old belief. We saw that in John 2, because Jesus even said, I know what's inside there. No. Saving faith has got to be a change. There has to be regeneration. There has to be born again. And then if we look at born again, we see what the traits of someone that's been born again is. Okay, so we see those things. We start seeing what saving faith looks like, what born again actually looks like. And Zane Hodges and all those say nothing more is needed, and they're right. It's not needed. But it will be a product of that. That's how he tells us. We don't have Jesus telling us, yes, you have faith. No, you don't. Eh, you're almost there. No. But he tells us in here, right? Isn't he showing us here? He's giving us at least something to go by so that we're not one of those later on that say, but Lord, Lord, I believed. I believed in the signs or whatever it is, right? I just got really hot, so I wilted there. No, he's going to say, no, you've got a bad heart. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 1, please. Now, this is something that maybe you guys have not used this tactic when looking at apostasy, looking at belief, looking at saving faith, but it's one that hopefully will be something that you'll consider. Have you ever noticed anything about Peter's use of the word faith or belief in Peter? Or actually, should I say, have you ever noticed anything about his use of obedience? That word. Now here's the thing. We need to know different scriptures like this, because this section right here in Peter, we're going to use to help exegete our passage next week. We need to know different scriptures, so whenever we read Hebrews 3, 6, and 10, we can know what they cannot mean. We know they must mean something else than that. And it's going to actually maybe even help us. Look, let's look at Peter's use of the word obedience or obey. Let's take a look. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 14. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. That's not kind of weird to say. You guys are really obedient, okay? You're super obedient children. Don't be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. Wait a minute, you're warning someone that's obedient children to not be conformed. They're already being obedient. You see, what would we put in there if we were going to write something? We would say, as children of God, right? Something like that, as opposed to obedient children, as God's children. Because you're God's children, do not be conformed to the passions of your ignorance. But what does he call them? He doesn't call them God's children, covenant children, whatever it is, right? He says, as obedient children. Wait, if they're obedient, why is he warning them against going into passions? Let's go down to chapter 2. Chapter 2, he's telling them of the gospel. Verse 6, he starts speaking about it a little bit more. He speaks about believers and how they react to it, right? The stumbling stone, and the ones that do, it's good. The ones that don't, it's a stumbling stone, right? He speaks of those who believe it is a stone of stumbling. And then look at the last portion of verse 8. They stumble because they disobey the word as they were destined to do. They disobey the word? He was talking about belief, people that would believe the gospel message or not. But he doesn't use the term belief, does he? They disobey the word. It seems he's talking about them not believing the word, but he says they disobey it as they were destined to do. Predestined to do. Now, we may say they were destined not to come to belief because of their total depravity or whatever. Or, you know what I mean, right? But you see what he does? Peter again equates obedience or disobedience here with unbelief. He doesn't call them believers or God's children. He calls them obedient children. He doesn't call them unbelievers here, but he calls them this set of disobey the word. Look at verse 3, or excuse me, chapter 3. Go up to chapter 3. Chapter 3 and verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so even if some do not obey the word, they must be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. You mean you try to win somebody over to obedience? Or is he talking about them coming to belief? And you see what he does again? He uses the word obey, where you and I, if we were going to write that right, we would say exactly opposite. We would say, so that even some that do not believe the word may be won over. You see what I'm saying? Everywhere in 1 Peter, He uses the word obey or obedience where you or I would write in belief or faith, right? God's children instead of obedient children. He says some don't obey the word. But what is he really saying? They don't believe the word. What is he really saying then? He's equating belief and obedience. They seem to be inseparable, right? Contra Hodge, right? Belief and obedience seem to be inseparable. They're interchangeable to Peter. They mean one and the same thing. As the jingle goes, you can't have one without the other. Obedience and faith interchangeable to Peter. Verse 18. Go down to verse 18. For Christ also suffered for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, being made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the day of Noah while the ark was being prepared. Why are they in torment now? For unbelief towards Noah's preaching or because of their disobedience? Which is it? I say yes. It's both. If you or I were to write this, we would write they are in torment because they did not believe righteous Noah's preaching. Would we put down obey? Or would we say they didn't believe the message that he was preaching? Right? Because here's the thing. The gospel message is a command to begin with, is it not? To repent and to believe, that's in the imperative. Starting off, you have to obey. He wasn't calling them just to obey. Because who would pay for their sins? Who would do those things? He was calling them to believe the message. But you see, Peter can't separate the two. He can't separate it. Belief are the same as obedience. Belief or salvation is by faith alone. Absolutely. But as James basically says, faith is never alone. It will always be accompanied by obedience, right? That's why this grace evangelical movement is death and it's spreading like a plague in most of the churches today. The people in John 2 would have the okie-dokie if they were in a church like that. They would be secure. Carnal Christian would be secure. One that heard the message but it never went into a born-again heart, right? And wilted, and forever is laying there wilted, they are still secure. Go to chapter 4. Take a look at chapter 4 of 1 Peter. Chapter 4, verse 17. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? His question, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? Doesn't he mean believe the gospel of God? See, he says, we're in the household. Well, what's going to happen to those that are not in the household that don't obey the gospel? You know what he's saying. He can't separate the two. Because once that grace comes upon you and you're changed, you are a new creation. It will be that result. Think about this, right? Just chapter 14, really the whole epistle, but just chapter 4 here. He's told them of slander, of trials, of tribulations coming at them. Right? Of suffering, severe suffering, just in chapter 4. Okay? He's urged them at the beginning of chapter 4 to do what? To not return to drinking, party, and orgies. Don't go back to lawlessness, sensuality, passions, but to stand firm. Guess what that means? Persevere. In the will of God. Verses 2 through 4 right there. But really all of this chapter, he sums it up with a question, and what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Because he's talking to Christians and he's saying, you know what, you've got these things, you need to stand firm no matter what. You know, what's going to be the outcome if you're not obeying the gospel? What is he saying? You're in, right? But if you're in, you need to stand fast and you need to do that. Obey instead of believe. You see, to Peter and to John and to Jesus and to the writer of the Hebrews, all of this, belief, new birth, saving faith, all of that is going to have obedience to God in it, or as a result of it, right? That is the truth. It's the very basis that we're going to see next week. It's the very basis that the writer of the Hebrews gives his warning to. It's going to be the very basis of it. The obedience towards God is the fruit of the new birth, right? It is the fruit of faith. And any tree that does not bear good fruit will be cut down. It's a warning here, all right? Hebrews 3, the whole epistle is a warning. So that none will be deceived. So that at the end they're not saying, but Lord, Lord. No, they know. They've been instructed on apostasy. The entire book is full of that. Lord willing, what we learn today, the truths about belief, saving faith, about being disciples, truly disciples of the Lord, will help us our next Lord's Day to interpret our passage clearly. Let's pray.